Today is Wednesday, March 22nd. We're going to be working more on the digestive system organs today. So why don't we just start from the top with the salivary gland information on 84. We actually have three major sets of salivary glands scattered around our mouth. We have a parotid set that sits over the masseter muscle. We have a sublingual set under the tongue and submandibulars under the jawbone. These, of course, release saliva. So what is located or what is found in saliva? Amylase, good. So that's an important enzyme. It is helpful for breaking starch into what?
Sugar.
Sugar, good. So simple sugars like glucose are made from starch. So, you know, we talked in here on Monday about the fact that saliva is a liquid. It's mostly water. It does contain mucin, which helps you with knowing whether or not you need to drink. The thicker your saliva, the more mucin there is, and the more rubbery your saliva tastes. So we tend to drink to make our saliva taste less rubbery to our mouths. But the most important component besides mucin and water and electrolytes is, of course, that salivary amylase. It does begin starch digestion, but you would have to hold your food for roughly 20 to 30 minutes to get starch to fully break down into sugars. The job of transforming starch into sugar is actually completed in your small intestine. So we'll talk about that completion process a little later on. Okay, let's talk about the physiology of the mouth down near the bottom of your page. Three main functions of your mouth, including salivary functions: ingestion of food. What does that mean in plain English? Yeah, put food in your mouth to eat. Good. Of course, chewing is called mastication. That helps to break our food into smaller particles. Mixes that food with other things like saliva and amylase. And the only chemical digestion we talk about here is amylase that breaks down starch into sugars. So kind of as a side note, before we wrap up the mouth entirely, I wanted to share some issues that can occur with salivary glands. You know, salivary glands can produce salivary stones, just like kidney stones, but dehydration can lead a person to have salivary stones. Otherwise, electrolyte imbalances can also lead to those stones. Now, those stones can block the ducts that drain the saliva out of the glands, and those ducts can, of course, prevent the saliva from leaving the gland and lead to swelling. And what you see here on this side is actually a cyst that's formed in that salivary gland. I had a student a few years ago who had salivary cancer. She had had a big portion of her salivary glands removed. You know, they are made up of simple cuboidal tissue. Epithelial is notorious for reproducing quickly. And in the case of a quickly reproducing tissue, it's more likely to have problems like cancers. She had had part of her glands removed, but she didn't have insurance at the time and was actually just living with salivary cancer in another portion of our jawbone area. So she was waiting until she had insurance before she had the remainder of those salivary glands removed. So this is another important reason for having saliva. Saliva is important for the health of your teeth. Without it, the bacteria in your mouth have a field day and can produce cavities and tooth decay. And not only that, but meth is a very acidic type of chemical. Combine that with the lack of saliva and you have a ripe situation for massive tooth decay like you see here. Would not want to be this person's dentist or dental hygienist. Not in any case. I don't think they're seeing those people. The last issue that can affect the salivary glands is one that we do have vaccines for. It's called the mumps. And there's a vaccine called MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella. And there's a double dose of that vaccine that most kids get when they're growing up. That particular vaccine prevents a viral infection that sets up in the salivary glands. Unfortunately, in boys, it can also cause testes to swell and sterility. So it's a very important reason for having that MMR vaccine. But that looks pretty painful to have those salivary glands swollen around the face. All right. Looks like we're ready to move along to the pharynx. That one is found on page 85. So why do we not consider the nasopharynx part of our digestive system? You don't put food in there yet. It's above the nasopharynx, or it's above the soft palate. Food does not go into that area. that's actually the back of your nasal cavity. So unless you're snorting food literally through your nose, there shouldn't be any food in that nasopharynx region. So we don't really discuss it here. We do instead discuss oropharynx at the back of your mouth and the laryngopharynx, which is down at the point where we route air and food into their proper passageways. Now, there's not a whole lot going on here. We simply route air and food. We use the pharynx as a swallowing portion of our digestive tract, but otherwise nothing exciting goes on here except for swallowing. So you'll notice that swallowing is a two-phase process known as deglutition. Deglutition has a voluntary phase called the buccal phase, and an involuntary phase called the pharyngeal esophageal phase. None of us think consciously about swallowing our food, but you actually are making a decision about it. When you've chewed your food and you moisten it into a little ball called a bolus, you consciously make the decision to push it to the back of your mouth. You initiate the swallowing process, and that's the buccal portion of swallowing. Now, once you've made that decision and you've already initiated swallowing, you no longer have control over that food until it's coming out the other end. Everything from this point on is going to be an involuntary process. So that pharyngeal esophageal phase involves the pharynx and the esophagus. Esophagus. And of course, that gets us into a rhythmic contraction called peristalsis that moves those food particles down into the stomach. So really, this is it for our voluntary contribution to digestion. Once you swallow, using the buccal phase, it's out of our hands. All right, so now we're moving along to the esophagus. So what two organs does the esophagus connect? Good, stomach and the laryngopharynx, good. What type of tissue lines the esophagus? Stratified squamous, right? Okay, so why is stratified squamous a good tissue for the esophagus? Protection. Yeah, what's traveling down is rough food, and that food can abrade and tear away the outer several layers. So you definitely need multi-layered tissue there to help avoid having that food poke into underlying tissues. Even though you've got many layers here, you've got to replace those cells with new ones. You know, we're constantly growing new cells here in the esophagus. So every 2 weeks, you've got an entirely new crop of cells that replace the old. And so, you know, that's to keep that food from abrading and wearing down those layers of the esophagus. So the esophagus is nothing more than a gullet. It is a passageway for food. There's no digestive or absorptive function here. The goal is to transfer that food into the stomach, where we really now are going to begin that full-on digestive process. I do want to remind you that in the esophagus, there is no serosa layer on the outermost covering. We only have the innermost mucosa. We have the submucosa. They call it lamina propria here. There are two layers of muscle. Muscularis externa has an inner circular and an outer longitudinal layer. But in this thoracic cavity, there's no serosa covering that esophagus. So what is important about it is there is peristalsis occurring to help move food and liquid down to your stomach. It only takes a second or two for liquid to hit your stomach. It may take as many as 5 or 6 seconds for a piece of food to hit your stomach. So sometimes you may have swallowed something and you can feel it travel all the way down. You may in fact feel the rhythmic contractions as the food seems to move all the way down that esophagus. In some cases, people have esophageal spasms, and that sphincter sitting at the top of the stomach may spasm shut, and then food can't get into the stomach, so it backs up in the esophagus. So it tends to be something that comes with age. It also tends to be a case we see more often in women than in men. And if you eat large pieces of food that are unchewed rather than small, tiny chewed bites of food, more likely to produce an esophageal spasm. Likewise, if you alternate hot and cold, you know, if you have a hot beverage that relaxes your esophagus and follow that with something cold, that's more likely to produce an esophageal spasm. But if you've never had one, that's a fortunate place to be. But the chance of having them does increase with age. All right. So here is the exact junction between your esophagus and your stomach. Notice the esophagus has stratified squamous epithelium. What type of tissue lines the stomach? BIO-210 tissues of Lift, right? It is simple tissue. It is simple columnar. Okay, and so the exact point of transition is actually histological, meaning it's tissue. So if you want to say this is the point we transition from esophagus to stomach, you'd actually look for the transition between stratified squamous and simple columnar. It's completely abrupt. Most of the time, though, we look at that upper, you know, that whether the lower esophageal sphincter or cardiac sphincter is being the dividing point, but it may be sitting several, you know, centimeters or inches away from where this transition actually takes place. So in cases where a piece of the stomach is protruding above your diaphragm, we call that condition a hiatal hernia. So now that we know that we've got simple columnar in the stomach, that simple columnar tissue and its juices are now sticking up above the thoracic cavity in that diaphragm region where the heart is sitting. So what are some problems with having a hiatal hernia? Pain. That's the problem. You've got secretion of gastric juices, right, that reach up into the esophagus. And even though the esophagus is made up of stratified squamous, it does not have a thick mucus lining. So what that means is now you've got gurgling acid coming up into your esophagus, and it can actually erode away and cause problems like you see here. These are esophageal ulcers. They look like cancer, don't they? So that can come from gastroesophageal reflux disease. It can be introduced by a hiatal hernia where you've got gastric juices gurgling up into your esophagus. And nonetheless, your esophagus is not built to handle acid. It's built to transmit food to your stomach, not to deal with it coming back up. So what are some things that can induce a hiatal hernia? Stretching your stomach, eating big meals on a routine basis. Okay, pregnancy can do it for females. Obesity can also do it. It can push that stomach up through the opening of the diaphragm. So we know the diaphragm's opening is called the hiatus. Therefore, the hernia is a hiatal hernia through that opening in the diaphragm.
So is that like, that's acid reflux?
That's acid reflux, yeah. That's a really bad case scenario of acid reflux. I'm sure that person has quite some pain. All right, so how about questions so far on mouth, salivary glands, pharynx, or esophagus? Y'all so far so good today? Okay, let's talk about the stomach. It's at the bottom of your page. So we've now transitioned from the upper digestive system to the lower. That passage through the diaphragm now puts us down where all the business takes place. The stomach and small intestines are going to contribute a lot to the process of digestion and absorption. So let's start by talking through the anatomy of the stomach. So the stomach and esophagus meet here at a sphincter. This sphincter is sometimes called the LES for lower esophageal sphincter. What's another name for it? Cardiac sphincter, right, because it's close to the heart. Okay, there is in fact an upper esophageal sphincter at the top of your esophagus. We don't often talk about it, but it's actually the first of our sphincters in our digestive passageways. This lower esophageal sphincter sits right at the diaphragm and should be a point that keeps the food from passing back up into your esophagus. There are four regions of the stomach. The portion closest to the esophagus opening is what? Cardia, good. The portion that extends out? Fundus. The main region? Good. And the last terminal portion?
Pylorus.
Good. Okay. So you notice the stomach is a J-shaped pouch. It sits so that the food channels down toward the pyloric region. And if you eat more and more and more, it continues to make the fundus portion, this greater curvature here, expand out. During a really large meal, we can stretch our stomachs to hold as much as a gallon of food. I don't know about you, but I look at a gallon, like a gallon of milk, and I think, I don't know how I could put that in my stomach, you know? But, you know, most meals hold somewhere between 3 and 4 cups of food. But if you routinely stretch your stomach by having large meals, you know, they say you can hold ultimately that much food in your stomach. That's a lot of food. That'd be one meal a day if you were eating a gallon at a time, right? Okay, that should do it for the bottom of that page there. Let's flip on over to page 86. We actually have two sphincters here. We've talked about the upper one, which is called the lower esophageal sphincter or cardiac sphincter. There's also a pyloric sphincter down here at the other end. What's the function of that pyloric sphincter? Good, from the stomach to the small intestine. And of course, that sphincter regulates the emptying of the stomach and how quickly the contents can pass into the small intestine. So that's what we're looking at here, is regulating the contents being drained. Okay, we also know the inside of your stomach has a wrinkly appearance when your stomach's empty. We call it rugae. You don't see this when the stomach is full because those walls stretch out to accommodate food. Looks like a brain, doesn't it? Not in your course pack, but I know you guys have studied this in lab. I just wanted to tie back in a couple of lab issues. I know you've talked about the greater and lesser curvatures. That greater curvature is the larger curve there on the bottom of the stomach. And from that curvature, we hang a fatty apron known as the greater omentum. What's the function of that omentum?
Insulate.
Protect. Good. Good. So it does hang like a fatty apron over the lower portion of your digestive system. There is a lesser omentum that hangs from your lesser curvature. And to what organ does it attach? It actually goes up to your liver. You can't see it in this picture, but there's a lesser omentum that hangs from the lesser curvature and around your liver. So when they talk about visceral fat or belly fat, there's actually two kinds of fat in our abdomens. There is subcutaneous fat between the skin and the underlying muscle tissue. That is fat that you could technically suck out through liposuction. It's in the hypodermis of the skin. Now, this, however, is a different kind of fat. This fat is literally over the viscera or the organs of our digestive system. So this is the fat they often talk about when they advertise on TV about get rid of your visceral, your organ fat. It's meant to protect those underlying cells and tissues. So it actually does have a very important purpose down there. So I just want to mention there's two kinds of fat, or actually two layers of fat, since there's no bony protection over those lower digestive organs. All right. Let's talk about the microscopic structure of our stomach. We already know the lining or mucosa layer is made up of simple columnar epithelial tissue. And since we're talking about simple columnar, we're talking about various types of cells here that produce secretions for the stomach. Let me start you with the enteroendocrine cells. So in this picture, let's get you one. I know I've got them on here somewhere. Take them out. Maybe I did, maybe I took them out. Okay, so not in this particular picture, but embedded within this gastric pit are specialized cells called enteroendocrine cells. I think the word endocrine is a really helpful clue, because what do endocrine glands release? Hormones, right. So this particular cell is basically a hormone-releasing cell, and the type of hormone it releases is called gastrin. So you'll notice that gastrin is one of many important hormones released by your stomach. Lo and behold, it is yet an endocrine gland. So I know we thought we were done with that chapter, but yet we've got another one here with the stomach. So you'll notice that gastrin is released by the stomach to stimulate the production of hydrochloric acid, an intrinsic factor. So this starts the ball rolling. So if we talk about food, if we smell food, if we see food, or if we taste food, those kinds of activities tell your brain that you must be interested in eating, and then your brain sends a nerve by way of your vagus nerve. So it sends a nerve impulse down to your stomach by way of your vagus nerve. The vagus nerve comes to those enteroendocrine cells, and now gastrin is present in your stomach. So gastrin will talk to your parietal cells, and it will tell your parietal cells to release hydrochloric acid, an intrinsic factor. When you're no longer interested in eating, when you've done the job, eating is over, we can shut off gastrin using which hormone? GIP, yeah. Gastrin-inhibiting peptide, or GIP, will in fact cut off gastrin production. So let's hit that from the top. If you're interested in eating, you've talked about it, you smell food, you see food, you taste food, you're actively eating food, any of that can help induce the release of a nerve impulse along your vagus nerve. This is parasympathetic control. We travel to our enteroendocrine cells and release gastrin. Once gastrin's in the stomach, gastrin travels to your parietal cells through the bloodstream and tells your parietal cells to release hydrochloric acid, an intrinsic factor. So what does hydrochloric acid do to the pH in your stomach?
Makes it really low.
Makes it really low, yeah. On average, we're looking at a pH around 1 or 2 when hydrochloric acid is pumping in. And that is important because of two reasons. Hydrochloric acid is going to help activate pepsinogen into pepsin. That's going to be a key factor for us. And when you transform pepsinogen into pepsin, what does that help you break down?
Proteins.
Yeah, it helps you break down proteins. So we've got two reasons here to have hydrochloric acid. Transform pepsinogen into pepsin. Pepsin then helps us break down proteins. Intrinsic factor is also a really important production by your stomach. It's made by your parietal cells. And you'll notice that intrinsic factor is important for vitamin B12 absorption in your small intestine. Let's think big picture here. We've talked about vitamin B12 and its role in making red blood cells. Okay, so that's the first question there. Vitamin B12 is important for making red blood cells. What type of anemia results if you're vitamin B12 deficient?
Pernicious.
Pernicious, good. So pernicious anemia results if you're vitamin B12 deficient. That one's P-E-R-N-I-C-I-O-U-S. Sure. So let's talk about this for a minute. A lot of people take medications called proton pump inhibitors. These drugs are marketed under the names Prilosec, Nexium, good gosh, just, you know, a whole bunch of these drugs out there. And these drugs are meant to stop acid production or to reduce acid production by your stomach. If you've got an overly acidic stomach, if you have acid reflux or GERD, this may be the drug to help reduce that acid production. Okay, so let's think big picture here how this would affect us. If you reduce hydrochloric acid production by the stomach, what happens to the pH in your stomach? Goes up. Yeah, so instead of being a really strong 1 or 2, now we're looking at a pH somewhere maybe around 3 or 4. So why is it really important to have a strong acid condition in your stomach? Yeah, break down bacteria and transform pepsinogen into pepsin. What does pepsin break down? Proteins, yeah. So you've got a couple of things there to be worried about, because now we could affect protein digestion, and you're right, you affect the destruction of that bacteria that comes from your nasal cavity. So now we start seeing why we could influence other things. Maybe this person would get more sick more often if they happen to take a proton pump inhibitor. A lot of those drugs aren't meant for long-term use. We know we cycle them on and cycle them off, but you can see why long-term use of a proton pump inhibitor would impact our stomach's production of, you know, acid and protein digestion. Okay, so let's talk about the chief cells next. Those chief cells produce pepsinogen. Pepsinogen is an inactive form of a chemical called pepsin. Okay? And pepsin is important because it helps to break down proteins. But what pH environment do you need? Acid. Yep, need acid environment. So pepsinogen relies on these parietal cells to release hydrochloric acid because hydrochloric acid activates pepsinogen into pepsin. All right, so then we've got mucus neck cells that are in these gastric pits in the stomach. And these mucus neck cells are going to release a really thick layer of mucus that coats the stomach lining. You know, if you think about a pH of 1 or 2, that's pretty strong. You don't want the stomach to be digested by its own juices. So covering the entire layers of simple columnar tissue here is a thick layer of a mucus. So that is to help prevent the stomach from literally digesting away its own tissues. All right, so then we have something called renin. That one is spelled R-E-N-N-I-N. I want to make sure that we see the difference. We also talked about a renin back with the urinary and aldosterone process. That particular one was spelled with one N. This particular one is an enzyme, and this particular enzyme breaks down milk proteins. So during what time of life do you think this one is most active? Infants. Yeah, babies and infants have an active set of renin molecules. After age 3, most of us lose a lot of our renin. That means after age 3, most of us have difficulty breaking down what? Milk. Yeah. So milk proteins specifically, there is an enzyme called lactase that breaks down sugar in milk called lactose. But, you know, if you combine lactose intolerance with a deficiency of renin, no wonder adults have problems with milk products. You know, diarrhea, gas, all that good stuff. So renin is most active in babies. It actually takes milk proteins and turns them into something that looks like cottage cheese. So when babies spit up something that looks like curds of cottage cheese, in fact, it's probably renin doing its job. So a lot of moms think it's most likely a sour stomach, but it's active renin doing its job. Last one there is ghrelin. It sounds like ghrelin, and that's what, of course, induces appetite stimulation in our stomach, another hormone called ghrelin. So let's hit this from the top. This is the review at the bottom of the page. We're going to start with the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve works for which autonomic nervous system division? Parasympathetic. Good. So when we are thinking about food, tasting food, smelling food, anything that has to do with food, then the vagus nerve gets activated. That tells the enteroendocrine cells to produce gastrin. What is gastrin?
Hormone.
Good. And like all hormones, they travel through the bloodstream. So this hormone travels through the bloodstream to target the stomach itself. Do you find that kind of unusual? The stomach makes a hormone to talk to itself. Okay, so gastrin is made by the stomach. It goes through the bloodstream and comes back to the parietal cells, and they release hydrochloric acid, an intrinsic factor. Is gastrin, triggers the release of gastrin. And then it says, which stimulates parietal cells to release blank and blank. On the left is HCL, and on the right is intrinsic factor.
What was the first one again?
That first blank there, vagus nerve stimulates the release of gastrin. And that stimulates the release of, on the left, HCL, and on the right, intrinsic factor. We know that hydrochloric acid is going to be important for an acid environment in the stomach. That helps us convert pepsinogen into pepsin, helps us convert pepsinogen into pepsin. And on the right-hand side, Intrinsic factor is needed for the absorption of vitamin B12. Good.
What was number three? Very little absorption.
Oh, we're going to head back up there. It's alcohol and aspirin. Okay, so to summarize the stomach's physiology, three main jobs here. So far we've talked about mechanically breaking down food through peristalsis. We're going to talk more about how long that takes and what types of food groups are going to slow the digestive process. We'll do that on the next page. We also know that chemical digestion is going to start to occur here. Basically, we're breaking down proteins and milk proteins. Not much else in terms of carbs or lipids or even nucleic acids. So proteins are hard to digest. They're very large. So that's why we start the process here in the stomach. There's really not a lot of absorption here. We do limit absorption to alcohol and aspirin. Those two are a deadly duo taken on an empty stomach because they go right into the bloodstream. Some water is absorbed here, but we save most water absorption for later on in the intestines. So those blanks there, yeah, for alcohol and aspirin. Do you have questions on any part of this page? So let's talk about how your stomach deals with food. Your stomach is going to be controlled by either nervous system controls or by the hormones. We know the vagus nerve works for the parasympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system, and that controls the stomach's activities. The hormone that primarily controls stomach activities is gastrin. So we've talked about how those two are induced when you're talking about food, seeing it, smelling it, and so forth. So when your stomach decides that you must be getting ready to eat, it begins with a process that produces chemicals, and it begins grinding. So let me take you through the three phases of the stomach's activities, starting with phase one, the cephalic phase or the head phase. So tell me what your favorite food is.
Steak.
Crab legs, that sounds good.
Pizza.
I was waiting for that one. Some people have told me they like, you know, hot fried chicken with mashed potatoes and gravy. They've talked about steak every semester. Somebody always mentions pizza. Okay.
Salmon.
You know, what else?
Salmon.
Salmon, that's good. Yeah, crab leg salmon. Or if maybe hot chocolate cake with some icing and ice cream right out of the oven, something like that may sound good to you. Okay, so if you start really thinking about these foods, then we are messing with your cephalic phase. That's the head phase of eating. So even we haven't seen the food, we haven't smelled it, we haven't tasted it, we're just talking about it. That tells your vagus nerve that you must be getting ready to eat, and therefore we start telling the stomach that food must be coming. So this is going to tell the vagus nerve to send nerve impulses to your enteroendocrine cells, and in response, what type of hormone do you release? Gastrin. Yes, so you start releasing gastrin. And of course, gastrin tells your parietal cells to release acid and intrinsic factor, and all this is happening before you ever take a bite of food. All right, did you get your blank there? Vagus nerve? Okay. Well, once you're actively eating, we are now involved in step two or phase two called the gastric phase. So now you're pushing food to your stomach is going to grind this food, and you'll notice the way the food is situated, it's going to slide down toward the pyloric region, and it will push out that fundus region if you start to fill up your stomach. So this process is a feedback loop to your vagus nerve that says, hey, we're in the midst of eating, the stomach stretches, that tells our brain that we're starting to get full. But we're going to encourage the release of chemicals now because we're actively digesting this food. So when you're in the middle of a meal, you know, you've just started eating, you're in the middle of the meal, This is the gastric phase of stomach activity. We're going to encourage the stomach to release chemicals like hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor. So right now it's game on, digest away. Once your stomach starts emptying the food, we now enter what's called phase three, or the intestinal phase. And you'll notice that when the stomach is starting to empty foods into your small intestine, the small intestine actually fights back. The small intestine says, hey, don't send me stuff so fast. I can only take about a teaspoon's worth of food at a time. So your small intestine actually says to your stomach, stop secreting so many juices and slow down your activities. Don't send me food so fast. And here's why. You can hold upwards of a gallon of food in the stomach. Like we said, not that you're going to eat that much, but look at the size of that small intestine. Can you empty all that food into the small intestine at once? You can't get overwhelmed that tiny tube. So in order to accommodate for the size of the tube, our stomach empties over a period of approximately 4 to 6 hours. It takes that long to finally get your stomach completely empty. So the reflexes here push back on your stomach, tell it to slow down. And in fact, this reflexive process is called the enterogastric reflex. Along the same time, we're also going to produce a hormone called GIP, gastrin inhibiting peptide. You know, game's over now, show's over, all the activity in the stomach is going to come to a stop. That's because we're emptying the stomach's contents into the intestines. So what effect does GIP have on the stomach? Yeah, makes it less acidic. It stops gastrin production. Why would this make the stomach less acidic? Hydrochloric acid, yeah. So gastrin normally tells your parietal cells to make acid. GIP comes along to your enteroendocrine cells and says, hey, stop making gastrin. No more gastrin means we can no longer make hydrochloric acid. Now the pH in the stomach begins to increase. The show's over, the food is moving out to the small intestine. So GIP actually increases stomach pH. It stops the activities by shutting off gastrin. We'll talk a little bit about cholecystokinin as well. It's actually made to induce bile production by your liver and gallbladder, but we'll come back to that. It's also going to play a role in shutting down the stomach's activities. So in summary, we've actually got three phases here. We've got a head phase that turns on your stomach, tells your stomach to get ready, food must be coming. We have a second phase, the gastric phase. It's during the active eating period. That too encourages stomach activities. And then the last phase, the intestinal phase, utilizes a reflex called the enterogastric reflex. What impact does this have on stomach activities?
Stops it.
Stops it, right. So to summarize, the first two phases encourage stomach secretions. The last phase, that third phase, stops stomach activity and secretions. So phase one and phase two encourage stomach activities and secretions. Phase three stops it. Down below, you've got gastric motility and emptying. The stomach usually empties within about 4 to 6 hours of a meal. Within 4 to 6 hours of a meal. So let's think about what kinds of meals make you feel full for a longer period. Protein, meats, yeah. Protein-rich meals will do it. Okay. What about fatty meals? They'll also make you feel full longer. Large meals also do it. What about carb-rich meals? You ever eat a Muffin for breakfast? How long is it before you're hungry? An hour if you're lucky, right? 30 minutes if you're not. Okay, so have you ever eaten an egg for breakfast? Then how long is it before you're hungry? A couple hours, maybe a little bit longer. So protein is hard to break down. It does make you feel full for a longer period. And in fact, we need to start protein digestion in our stomachs because it's so hard to break down. We're going to finish the job in our small intestine. So protein-rich meals, lipids, fatty meals, and of course, big meals are going to keep the stomach full longer. It takes longer to empty those meals out. Carb-rich meals are quickly digested. They're not too difficult to break down. And unfortunately, that gets absorbed into our bloodstream and burned off. And so we have this yo-yo sugar high and sugar low if we eat a carb-rich meal. So if you want to maintain fullness and reduce calories, then eat protein-rich meals rather than carb-enriched meals. All right, so at the very bottom of your page, let's talk about some problems with the stomach. Gastritis is a catch-all term that means stomach inflammation. If you've had the flu and you've been vomiting, that could, of course, cause gastritis. So could food poisoning or any other virus that comes along and irritates your stomach. We often encourage the BRAT diet when a person has had gastritis. Bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast, and you'll notice what's not on the list. No cheese, no dairy products. So what is it about dairy products in adults? Hard to digest. Yeah, we don't have very much rennin. You know, if you're older than 3 years old, you probably don't make a lot of rennin. And so dairy products can irritate the lining of the stomach. Dairy products, by the way, can also increase mucus production, which can make you feel icky if you've already been sick and vomiting in the first place. So, you know, that's the negative side of dairy products in our diet. They can induce milk production, mucus production, rather. I did want to mention to you gastric bypass surgery, just as another issue. Gastric bypass surgery may take off the largest portion of the stomach and leave only a very small pocket hooked to your duodenum of the small intestine. So by doing this, we're cutting off most of the digestive activity of the stomach. So what are some problems, some health problems a person with gastric bypass may experience? Pernicious anemia.
Nutrient absorption.
Nutrient absorption, because you can't break them down in the stomach. Perhaps an increased pH, right? Which impairs what digestion? Carbs, lipids, proteins? Proteins, yeah. So if you have, say, a bypass surgery, you're looking at nutrient problems, nutrient absorption issues, anemia, like pernicious anemia. There's a whole host of problems that come with having this particular disorder, never mind the bleeding risk that comes from doing this type of surgery. They don't actually remove this piece of the stomach. They leave it connected. And I had a student years ago have this surgery, and it was the weirdest thing. She said that that piece of left behind stomach growled at mealtime. It wasn't getting anything to eat. It never ever was, but it growled at mealtime. And she said that all she could put in there was this piece, this little tiny pouch that holds about 2 to 3 ounces in a baby food jar. So she said it took months for that little pouch here to finally get the message that you're not getting anything, just stop growling. And so it eventually, I guess, got the message that it wasn't going to be part of that circuit anymore. This is one attempt at weight loss surgery. Another attempt that was popular during the 1980s and 90s was a vagectomy, and that was cutting the vagus nerve connection to the stomach. Do you think that was successful? So if you cut the vagus nerve, what kind of problems would result? Impaired parasympathetic, no gastrin production, less hydrochloric acid, less protein digestion, pernicious anemia. So they quickly found out that vagectomies were not a successful weight loss plan. Nowadays, it seems this is the going rate, you know, lap band surgery. It doesn't involve cutting off that piece of the stomach. It simply involves a band around that piece of the stomach that you can control or the doctor can control through an access port. problem with this one is if you eat a meal that's too large, it can also pop off that band and cause problems. But at least this is less invasive than, say, a cutoff that would be happening with that gastric bypass. I did want to mention stomach ulcers. You know, back 30 years ago, they also thought that stomach ulcers were mostly stress-induced. They thought that high-pressure jobs caused stomach ulcers. Well, the stress probably doesn't help, but nowadays we know that the ulcers are mostly caused by a bacterium. It's called Helicobacter pylori. Hey, pylori, it's in the pyloric region most commonly. So they can do an endoscope. They can run that down and look to see if you've got ulcers. They can also take a blood sample to see if you've got Helicobacter in your bloodstream. So an antibiotic can often kill these bacteria. It is a really common bacterium. You can get it from something as simple as drinking from a water fountain. And now I'm cured from ever drinking from any water fountain because of this. But most of us carry this thing. About 70% of us walk around with Helicobacter. It just doesn't cause infections in everybody. In certain people, it seems to cause infections, meaning it causes ulcers in those populations. All right, so that does it for this page. Do y'all have any questions so far on the stomach? Which makes you sick to think about having gone through all of that than to have the little pouch stretch. Yeah. Okay, so let's recap where we've been so far. The mouth has one major chemical digestive process. That is to break down what into what? Carbs and sugars. Good. So we used which enzyme in the mouth? Amylase, good. Okay, so we haven't mentioned carbs again. That's been the end of their story up until now. Let's go to the stomach. The stomach breaks down proteins. Can you tell me two enzymes that help to break down proteins in the stomach?
Pepsin.
And renin. Pepsin and renin. Okay, so pepsin and renin break down proteins. One specifically does milk, the other does just generic proteins. That's been the end of their story until now. And now we get to the small intestine where all nutrients are broken down and all the nutrients that we want are absorbed. And then that's it, okay? So the small intestine is kind of like this one-stop shop for nutrient digestion and absorption. So let's talk about the small intestine. Its anatomy is on the top of page 88. So tell me, what are the three regions in order?
Duodenum, jejunum.
Good. Duodenum, jejunum, ileum. How long is the small intestine in a cadaver? Yeah, like 20-something feet. Mm-hmm. And in a living person, muscle tone makes it appear much shorter. It's hard to believe that we have 25 feet of intestine packed into our abdomen. But that's a lot, and that's held together by muscle tone. Let's talk about the modifications. These villi are finger-like projections of the inside of your small intestine. Everything here is about increasing surface area. You wouldn't believe it, but 20 feet's not enough to do the nutrient absorption that we need to do. We have all these modifications to make the inside surface appear even longer. So these are villi, and villi have their own little tiny projections called microvilli. A lot of people tell me these look like Christmas trees or just trees. All these projections are about increasing surface area. And what they all do together is create a circular fold or a plicae circulaire. One is bracketed up there, and those behave as speed bumps to slow the passage of food through the small intestine. So these three modifications are about increasing surface area and maximizing absorption. In terms of intestinal juice, we're going to release around a liter or two of juice into the small intestine. That's a lot of fluid that you release per day. Most of it you reabsorb back into the bloodstream. So unless you have, say, a case of diarrhea or vomiting, you're probably going to regain most of that fluid. Also, notice the pH here. The intestinal pH is around 7.4 to 7.8. Anything familiar about those numbers? Good. Blood pH is 7.4. Right. So that is ideal because we want to absorb nutrients that have the same pH as our blood. Well, we had to come far, though. Look what we came from. What was the pH in the stomach?
1 to 2.
Yes, so we're coming quite a far away to get that pH close to blood pH. So that's critical. If you are to absorb acid directly into the bloodstream, what blood condition might you have? Acidosis, exactly. So having intestinal fluids here close to blood pH helps to avoid pH yo-yo problems, fluctuations. Okay, so we're going to talk through the main functions here. The small intestine is moving the food along by peristalsis. How would you describe peristalsis? Squeezing, rhythmic contractions, good, okay. And another job that occurs here is called segmentation. This is the only organ to have segmentation. So how would you describe segmentation?
Washing machine.
Washing machine, yep. It moves the food a little bit forward, a little bit backward, a little bit forward, a little bit backward. And in doing so, what are we mixing it with?
Chyme,
good. Juices, enzymes, chemicals. So we're giving that food a good mixing, and that's the function here of segmentation. It is the only place in your digestive system that we see it. Segmentation only occurs in your small intestine. Let's talk about chemical digestion. All food groups are broken down here, but we haven't really talked about fatty foods at all. So we do know that we have some fat to break down, and the fat is broken down in assistance with bile. So where is bile made? In the liver and stored in the?
Gallbladder,
good. So we of course need bile to come when we're eating food to help break down that fat. And so we're gonna work through this process of getting bile released into your small intestine. So bile is certainly important for fat breakdown, and so is something called lipase. Let me emphasize that bile is not an enzyme. It does not perform hydrolysis, okay? So hydrolysis is taking polymers of fat and turning them into their monomer building blocks, fatty acids and glycerol. That is not the function of bile. Bile, however, is an emulsifier. So let me give you an example. Dawn dishwashing liquid, 4 years, has advertised itself as the one that breaks up grease. They show on TV these nasty sinks full of greasy dishes, and they drop in Dawn, and this grease separates into these bubbles. So that's what Dawn does. It breaks up fatty molecules from big pieces into smaller pieces. Bile does the same exact thing. It takes big globs of fat and emulsifies them or breaks them into smaller, more manageable pieces. Okay? Once you've got bile doing that, lipase, an enzyme, comes along and hydrolyzes fat into its building blocks, fatty acids and glycerols. So if you don't have bile, if there's a liver problem or a gallbladder problem, the fat can't get absorbed and it stays in your feces. When a person passes the stool, the feces now float because fat is lighter than water. So floating feces indicate there may be difficulty with producing bile. So, you know, dogs always turn around and check out what they left behind. We should too. If you consistently produce floaters and not sinkers, then that means there's problems producing enough bile to break down your fats. So that alone can give us an idea of what's happening with our digestive system. Okay, so enough about poop. All food groups can get broken down here in the small intestine, but fats are certainly an important one that we need to break down. And then finally, absorption is a big issue here. We're going to absorb all our food groups that we want, and then any remaining nutrients that we don't absorb are passed through in the feces. Okay, how about questions about small intestine anatomy so far? So let's talk about absorption. This is the location to do the absorption. No other organ performs absorption for nutrients but the small intestine. That is its primary job, is to absorb the nutrients. When we absorb nutrients, they are moved either by diffusion, facilitated diffusion, active transport, some mechanism moves those nutrients into these capillaries inside each of our villi. And of course, those capillaries transport that fluid full of nutrients to venules, to veins, and then finally we're going to get that stuff moving in systemic circulation. Let's talk about the different food groups. Carbs. Where do we begin carb digestion?
Mouth.
Good. Using which enzyme? Salivary amylase. Good. We're going to finish the job here. This time we're going to use enzymes from the pancreas and from the intestine. Amylase, again, will help to finish the breakdown of starches into sugars. Maltase breaks down a sugar called maltose. What does sucrase break down?
Sugar.
Yep, table sugar, which is sucrose. And then lactase breaks down
milk.
Yeah, lactose, which is a milk sugar. So we do it all here. We break down all of our carbs. We break them into simple sugars. And those simple sugars get absorbed into the villi, into the bloodstream. Proteins we just got through talking about. Protein digestion begins where? Stomach. Good. We use which two enzymes to break down proteins?
Pepsin and renin.
Good. Which one of those breaks down milk proteins? Renin. Good. Now that we're in the small intestine, we're going to finish the job. We use intestinal enzymes and pancreatic enzymes. And notice this system here. Pepsin, trypsin, chymotrypsin. These all have sin endings. So proteins are sinful. The sin endings are going to break down those proteins into their building blocks. Do you recall the name of the building blocks for the proteins? Amino acids. Good. Good. So there is a teeny tiny bit of fat breakdown in your mouth. It's not really worth discussing, so we normally skip it. But I just wanted to put that out there, that there is a tiny, tiny bit of lipase in your mouth. Lipase does begin fat digestion to a very small extent. Now, once we move into the small intestine, we really begin the job fully. We do bile to emulsify the fats, and we use lipase, an enzyme, to hydrolyze or break apart those fats. Let's repeat what we just talked about. As an emulsifier, what does bile do to fatty molecules in your small intestine?
It breaks down large ones.
Good. Breaks large pieces of fat into smaller ones. It literally makes them more manageable. It does not hydrolyze fats into its building blocks. What chemical does do that job?
Lipase.
Lipase, good. So as an enzyme, lipase takes fat molecules and literally breaks them into their building blocks. Now we have fatty acid chains and glycerol heads. Okay, so these are a tag team. Bile comes in and punches up the fats, and lipase literally disassembles them and takes them apart. We don't talk a whole lot about nucleic acids, but we do digest them. They're in all the foods that we eat. Everything that we eat came from something else, whether it's plants, animals, fungi, or even protists. So these types of organisms carry their own DNA or RNA, and in the small intestine, we have nucleases that help to break apart those molecules. And, you know, you've probably heard the saying that you are what you eat. No joke. You take the DNA and RNA from other organisms, you break it down into building blocks called nucleotides, and then your body uses those nucleotides to assemble your own. So in reality, we do use the DNA and RNA from other organisms. We just reassemble it into our own needs. All right, let's talk about vitamins at the very bottom there. You'll want to know that A, D, E, and K are fat-soluble vitamins. ADEC. B and C are water-soluble vitamins. Which one should you take with food?
A, D.
Yeah, take A, D, E, and K with food because they're fat-soluble. If you take them on an empty stomach, you're less likely to absorb the maximum amount. B and C are water-soluble. You can take those on an empty stomach. Most of the time, they're absorbed without any, you know, excess food in your system. I do want to mention that we make vitamins B and K. I think of that as Burger King in our large intestine. So we'll talk more about that on the next couple of pages. But ADEC are fat soluble, B and C are water soluble. Y'all doing okay? Everything making sense today? Got any questions? Okay, just a little bit left about your small intestine there. With the electrolytes, you absorb iron and calcium if you need them. In fact, iron is absorbed better if you have vitamin C with it. Calcium is absorbed if you have parathyroid hormone present to help assist it back into the bloodstream. Notice that sodium absorption is coupled with glucose and amino acids. So that means you absorb sugar and salt and protein building blocks all together back into your bloodstream. Potassium is absorbed here by facilitated diffusion. So we're going to start tying this together with fluid electrolyte balance. If you happen to have diarrhea and you lose these electrolytes from being absorbed back into your bloodstream, does the loss of these salts primarily affect your osmotic pressure or your hydrostatic pressure? Osmotic pressure, right. So does that primarily affect the filtration process or the reabsorption process of capillaries?
Reabsorption.
Yeah, reabsorption. So what happens to the fluids that are pushed out?
Lymphatic
can pick them up, and if the lymphatic can't catch all of them,
swelling,
yeah. So if you have diarrhea, then that can lose electrolytes, that loses osmotic pressure, and we may in fact experience edema or swelling with that situation. So we're kind of starting to tie things together. That's something to hang on to and think about as we move into the latter parts of this course. Most of the water that we get is from the fluids that we drink, but we also reabsorb a great deal of fluids from our intestinal fluids. You'll notice in this picture that we secrete around 10 liters of intestinal juices, saliva, stomach juices every single day, and the majority of that is reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. Imagine if you did not reabsorb that, that'd be 10 liters of fluid a day that you would have to replace through either intravenous fluids or through drinking them. That's a lot of fluid to lose per day if you don't reabsorb it. All right, let's talk about large intestine. So why is it called large? It's big, right? It's not longer, it's just bigger, wider. Yeah, so bigger diameter here. So it's about 5 feet long, and it's incredible to think that we have 25 total feet of intestine crammed into our bodies, but there's a band of tissue here that kind of shrinks it up. What is that band? Tenia coli, good. So that's a band of longitudinal muscle. It acts as a rubber band to kind of cinch in the large intestine and make it fit into your abdominal cavity. Let's start on the regions. On the right-hand side, your ileocecal sphincter connects to your large intestine. You can't see it in this picture, but that sphincter is of great importance because it keeps feces from backing up into your small intestine. Feces have E. coli and other dangerous bacteria that can cause infection, so it's very important that that ileocecal sphincter keep closed to keep the feces from backing up. So when you come into large intestine, the first portion we encounter is this region here known as what? That's your cecum, good. Notice the cecum does have a blind sac, the appendix. What is its job? Not really sure? No, we're not really sure. So we think it plays a role in immunity. We think it collects bacteria. We of course know that it can rupture with an infection, but it doesn't seem to serve much purpose other than a lymphatic role and in immunity. So it seems to not have a great importance. Certainly we can live without it. Once we leave the cecum here on the right-hand side, we travel through three or four colon regions. As we go up the right-hand side, we're in the ascending colon. We make a right turn at what flexure? Hepatic, good. Come across through the transverse colon, make another turn at what flexure?
Splenic.
Splenic, good. And then we make descending turn here, of course, descending colon, and then now we're into an S-shaped turn. Sigmoid, good. And then finally it straightens out to the rectum, and then we're now transitioning from rectum to anus. This picture kills me. They don't leave the rest of the intestine on there. They just stop with the rectum hanging out in thin air. They could have gone ahead and showed us the anus, right, which is the last part of this system. All right, so here's the anus, of course, the terminal portion of your large intestine. And now, once again, we transition from simple columnar back to stratified squamous. So why do you think stratified squamous is a good fit for this location? Yeah, protection from abrasion. So feces pass through this region. We need a little extra protection from the abrasion that those feces provide. And in fact, there are anal columns here that are vertical to expedite the exit of the feces from the anus. While we're in this neighborhood talking about it, there are also valves. That's what this is sticking up here, that keeps feces from passing when we pass gas. They're supposed to point upwards in the anus, and so that should keep us from having accidents, as you know, passing gas and feces at the same time. All right, so we'll talk more about this as we get into the defecation reflex on the next page. All right, top of page 91, let's see what we've got there. We've got anal canal and rectum. Why don't we stop here and we'll pick up with physiology. That way we'll have a clean start with that topic on Monday. So I'll make a note that we're going to start with 91. We'll start with the accessory organs as well on Monday. All right, y'all have a good weekend.